1 millisecond per centimeter, 1 microsecond per centimeter, and so on. So when you speed up the scan rate of the oscilloscope, that calibration signal also speeds up. And a good cable would be a pure 50-ohm load, and therefore the square wave you apply to it would stay a square wave. Any echo on that chamber is going to show up as a small ghost on the trailing edge of the rise time and the fall time of the square wave that the oscilloscope is putting into the T-connector. Is that approximately what you're saying, John? Very crafty technique. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
The sawtooth output does vary. The calibration output does not vary with the sweep speed. But you could use either technique, and you will see the original pulse, which will trigger your scope. Now you'll have your traveling line. And if there is a bump, if somebody actually steps on the cable while you're doing it, you will see it, or if they twist the cable. And if it's properly terminated, the test will not fail you.
Okay, so you weren't using the calibrator. You said you were using the sawtooth sweep or the enabling pulse, the trigger pulse. Was this a pulse coming from the back panel? Tell us what was the name of the label of the connector of the oscilloscope that gave you the pulse that you did this test with. Over to you, John.
I usually did it with my HP pulse generator, and that's how I did it originally. But that was, we were using the sawtooth output. That will work also, and we could use the calibrator, but the calibrator was a little bit too wide. You need a little sharper pulse than that. It makes it a little easier to track. Very, very good system to use.
Yeah, I've forgotten the name of that pulse generator that's very popular at Hewlett-Packard. Something like 802. Do you happen to remember the number of the pulse generator you're talking about where you can set the pulse rip rate, the pulse duration, the polarity, the symmetry? It's got all kinds of knobs on the front panel. What was the model number on that machine, John?
You know, Dick, I have six of them in my lab. I don't remember one of the... I know it's a four-digit number, but I don't know. But they're basically all adjustable, without a doubt.
So what that really is, that's a poor man's time domain reflectometer. And by setting up a known good cable where you intentionally put a 25-ohm load instead of a 50-ohm load at the end of the cable, therefore you know ahead of time, mathematically, what's the value of the echo you're going to get off of that load because you know the standing wave ratio. Therefore you know what the echo should be, and then you look at what you see on that T-connector going into the front panel on the oscilloscope. And that's a way of calibrating the system, and therefore you can rate the quality of your cable. A time domain reflectometer really is a radar inside of a transmission line. You're transmitting a brief pulse, and if the transmission line was perfect, 50 ohms for the next mile, that pulse will go down the cable and none of it reflects back. And if the cable is pinched so that there's a place where it's 25 ohms, if there's an improper connection on the connector itself, if there's water in the cable, there's a whole lot of faults in the cable, which are a change in impedance, capacitive, inductive, resistive, whatever. Any minor change in the impedance of the cable creates a certain amount of reflected signal and a certain amount of transmitted forward signal, and the reflected signal will show up on that test. And so it's very quantitative, and it can be done with fairly inexpensive equipment. Crafty amateurs with very inexpensive equipment can do some very elaborate testing, as you can see, Bernie, just as long as you're crafty enough. K2 Yankee Oscar, and those guys in Brooklyn are pretty crafty. K2RIW in the TechNet.
One more good point for you, Dick.
Dick, I'd be curious.
Okay, yeah. John and Mel in that order. Go ahead, John.
Also, Dick, if you want to really experiment with it, you have a length of cable, say 50 feet, take any point on that line, take a hypodermic syringe and inject some water with a little saline in it, just a little bit, and watch the difference in that scope. You'd be amazed.
Sounds like you've done that test. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, Roger. Well, the Hewlett-Packard, they're popular. Bit on the antique side now. I bet you can buy them fairly cheap. Was the Hewlett-Packard 80 system, the 8011 and the 8015 pulse generators. And, of course, I could say I use I carry a TDR with me all the time with strap, hanging on my strap on my shoulder all the time, because that was my sort of, as they say, to rub my right hand, because that's all I dealt with coax problems almost all continuously. Well, you looked at the Hewlett Packard, they had a number of those pulse generators. The early version, I think you may remember, like the 200 series, the 214s and all, Dick. Maybe that's what you're alluding to, over.
Oh, you've hit it, Mel. It was the 8012, and I own one of those, and John owns three of them. We love this HP equipment. When we see it on the surplus market, we're a sucker for those deals. We can't turn them down. 8012 is the one I've used, and I think that can give you a rep rate of one pulse per second up to probably 50 million pulses per second, and you can measure, you can change the positive duration, the negative duration, the rise time, the fall time, the DC offset. You got all kinds of knobs on that front panel, as long as those pots stay clean, those slider switches stay clean. That can give you some very fancy signals. I don't care if that is a 1985 piece of electronics, a little bit on the old-fashioned size, but it's got real knobs on the front panel, and it's easy to grab those knobs, twist them, and get whatever you want out of this box, which is about, 10 inches wide, 6 inches high, 12 inches deep. Beautiful box. I don't care if it's 1985. The modern-day equivalent has all of those knobs, but they're hidden behind 14 separate menus, and everything is done by computer control, and you got to go to menu after menu to find one particular knob that you slowly start changing it, and you type into the keyboard to what change you want. That process, although it saves you some front panel space, it is so user-hostile by comparison to having 10 knobs on the front panel, tiny little round knobs, and you can grab each one of them, and you can have one knob in the left hand and one knob in the right hand, and you can get what you want in milliseconds, as opposed to going to menu after menu, and sometimes you can't find the thing you're wanting. So, I know you guys who are very computer savvy. Let me drop.
You're 100% right, Dick.
Hey, you guys who are very computer savvy are going to differ with me like crazy. You like saving space on the front panel, and you want everything to be digitally controlled. But compared to the old-fashioned techniques of having real knobs on the front panel, my goodness, can that make a difference. When it comes to using a spectrum analyzer to do a very high level of third-order intermodulation distortion test, and you're looking down 80 decibels from the two strong signals looking for the intermods, and you want to find out that those two intermods you're seeing on the screen, are they being caused by the spectrum analyzer, or are they being caused by the device under test? Let me drop. In the old days, you had a separate knob for everything. One of the knobs was the RF attenuator on the front panel. You grabbed that particular knob, you twisted it 10 more dB of attenuation. If every single signal on that screen, including the noise, so to speak, went down by 10 decibels, you pass the test, you know the spectrum analyzer is telling you the truth, and you're really seeing the intermods of everything coming into the spectrum analyzer. A modern-day spectrum analyzer will not let you do that. You go to the right menu, where you've got control of the RF attenuator on the front panel, and you dial in 10 more dB. The machine has a microprocessor inside that's hell-bent on making sure that every signal on the screen stays calibrated the same way. So you plug in, you demand that it give you 10 more dB of RF attenuation. The damn thing will increase its gain out back by 10 dB so that the top of the screen keeps the same amplitude level. So because they're adding attenuation but adding gain at the same time, and the added gain creates a change in the performance of the spectrum analyzer, you no longer can do the damn test. You can no longer measure the integrity of your intermod test. So when I run into one of these damn machines, I have to have a thoroughly separate physical RF attenuator that I plug into the front panel, because the knobs, the menus won't allow me to do what I want to do, if you know what I mean. It drives me crazy. So I know we're a little bit off subject, but maybe you'd get a kick out of some of this, Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2IO. I absolutely appreciate this. Thank you very much. And John's suggestion has intrigued me. I never thought about the fact that you should be able to, with a fast scope, you should be able to see that reflection. So I think I may have to set up a case and see if I can do that. Just a quick yes or no. I have a 200 meg scope. Should I be able to see the reflection with 200 megs?
Oh, boy. Like gangbusters. Now, if you're trying to make a measurement of a cable that's 6 inches long, and therefore the echo you're going to get back is only 1 nanosecond delayed, and therefore you need a scope of 1 gigahertz of performance to see it? No. But now you've got a 200 meg scope. 1 over 200 megs is 5 nanoseconds? Yeah, 5 nanoseconds. The round trip echo for a piece of cable is going to be 10 nanoseconds. 5 nanoseconds one way. Yeah, anything more than 5 feet of cable, you can easily measure with that as I see it, because rise time is really one-third of what I just calculated. I'm using slightly pessimistic mathematics. Yes. As long as you're measuring more than 5 feet of cable, your 200 meg scope on a good fast rise time pulse generator is going to give it to you, Bernie. Go ahead.
And answer for that too, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Just add another piece of cable, put it in series, and if there's anything wrong with the 6-inch piece, it'll show up too.
Fantastic. Smart guy. See, these hams are crafty, Bernie, as if you didn't know that. In other words, even the guys in Staten Island are almost as smart as the guys in Brooklyn. So if your scope is not fast enough, add an extra length of cable, then put the cable under test at the tail end of that, and now you've moved it into the range where the timing of the scope will show it to you. You got it, Bernie. Over to you, Bernie.
So they suggest using a TDR with it.
In other words, that's also a way of getting into the range of the TDR, because most TDRs will have a minimum range, just like a radar has a minimum range. I mean, if your radar is putting out a pulse that is 6 microseconds long, you are blind for the first 2 miles, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Bernie.
Well, Dick, you know what the difference is between those Staten Island guys and those Brooklyn guys, don't you?
I hope you're going to tell us.
Yes, a $7 toll when you have to go see him. Hi. Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate all this. I've got some good ideas here, and I've also got some experimenting I need to do just to, shall we say, make sure John's not leading me on. I know he's not, but I was one of those kids that when you said something's hot, I had to touch it to tell, so this is how we find out. Thank you, sir. Have a good evening. K2YO's clear.
You support the point that Johnny's precious.
Yeah, you're better equipped with equipment than you know about, Bernie. There's crafty ways of using very simple pieces of equipment. The manufacturers of these things will lead you to believe that without a $30,000 investment with a good TDR or a network analyzer, you're not going to be able to make these measurements. Not true. If you insist that your customer insists that you've got to make measurements traceable to the bureau with calibration, yeah, sometimes you need a $30,000 instrument. But to get a yes-no answer, a good-bad answer on a cable, and how bad, and whether or not you should open up that connector, some very instrumentation can tell it to you. Okay, we've gone beyond the first hour. Mel, tell us what's burning in your mailbag. After Mel's mailbag, as long as Glenn is available, KC2QIQ, and I know that John and Glenn, I want to reassemble the team that we had in the wee hours of Wednesday morning at 1 o'clock in the morning. From my point of view, a significant event took place, and if you're willing to be educated about the nuances of FM that are not well described in any of the books. We are all dependent on FM transmitters and receivers. You're using one right now. And what really goes on there and what you would see on a good display device is very different than a lot of people know about. And I think it's a good piece of information. I'll admit not everyone's going to appreciate it, but I think it should be told. K2KEY, go right ahead with the mailbag, Mel. K2LIW.
One more quick comment on the TDR, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, both of my Tektronix TDRs, they will only measure down to 1 foot, a 1 foot length, and that's a 2 microsecond pulse, by the way, on those units. So eventually, if you're going to do that, even on an expensive instrument like I have, you have to add cable to it. So I just thought Bernie would like to know that.
You said 2 microsecond. I wonder if you meant 2 nanosecond, and you're probably talking about the rise time of the pulse. In the case of a TDR function, the rep rate of the pulse really just gives you how much brightness you get on the screen. And the duration of the pulse, again, is part of the rep rate, because the TDR really only uses the leading edge of the pulse. So when you said a microsecond, did you mean nanosecond? And are you talking about rep rate or duration as opposed to sensitivity and briefness of rise time? Over to you, John.
I believe it's just the rise time, the 2 microseconds that they use to send the pulse down the line. That's about, it's a pretty basic system. And they, you're right, they only use the leading edge. It's just the spike going down there, and that's all it does.
Using it with transition time.
have a transition time in the picosecond category. And if it could do it in 2 picoseconds of transition time, then it would give you lots of resolution of the first foot of what's going on the cable. Go right ahead with the mailbag, Mel. KQRIW. I think we better stick to our schedule. People get awful angry at us. We've always been saying that during the first hour, we'll go to the mailbag because these guys are being kept up late. Right after the mailbag, we'll go to the quick one. Go ahead, Mel.
No, I just want to let you know the E5O machine's got no signal in Stamford, Connecticut.
Okay, you said the 850 machine has no signal. I'm listening to the 850 machine, so I'm very confused. Go ahead.
It must be on low power. That's all I want to let you know. I can barely get it in over here. I had to switch over to the 375. I noticed lately that and it doesn't seem like it has much power. I don't know if you guys had trouble with it, but I wanted to make you guys aware of it. All right, thanks for letting me get in here, KB1IFY. I just want to make you aware of it.
Yeah, there could be a funny propagation going on. My S-meter tells me I'm getting normal amplitude out of the 85 machine here on Long Island, 30 miles from the machine.
Staten Island.
In other words, you're getting the same signal strength as normal in Staten Island. That's not what you said, John. Go ahead.
That's correct.
So I think we got a funny kind of propagation going on up to Connecticut. Go ahead, Mel.
Hello in Bohemia.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah. My daughter says she's getting good reception. She listens in New Jersey. All right. Anyhow, yeah. I was just going to say real quick, the modern TDR, like I purchased, very reasonable price today if you're going to need an instrument that's sophisticated. What used to be in the many kilobucks today has all these menus on there with all kinds of pre-programming in for different types of cable. Everything is in it there and all. And they give you this calibrated length to do, like you say, if you're going to test cable shorter than a foot. So all comes with the system. Nothing of specialty anymore. All right. Let me see. I'm looking here. You know, here's one. Of course, it showed up again in QST. This problem of people asking me, you know, especially they're putting together antennas, 2-meter antenna stick, and they'd like to know, what's the story with this business with the mask? Do they have to have a non-metallic mask? Is there certain PVC pipe that's better to use for one of these antennas, as, you know, because they show you construction of PVC? What's the story with all this, Dick, really? Let's take it step by step with first the mask and material. Over.
If you're setting up a dipole, Yagi, or whatever, as a horizontally polarized antenna, which means the majority of the antenna is parallel to the surface of the Earth, then the mast that holds that down to your tripod, down to your chimney mount, or whatever, doesn't matter. Make it out of steel, aluminum, wood, fiberglass, PVC, doesn't matter. If the antenna is vertically polarized, and now your dipole and your directors are in line with that mast, yes, the mast does make a difference. And now, there's at least 2 schools of thought on this one. One school of thought says that if you understand how the Yagi works, the Yagi itself on 2 meters has an effective capture area of a significant number of square feet. A good 2-meter Yagi probably has at least 5 square feet of effective capture area. If your eyes operated at that frequency and you look down the throat of the antenna, you stand off a 1,000 yards and you look into that antenna and nose of it, you'll see this great big, multiple foot diameter, probably a 5-foot diameter or more, black hole in space, and that's when the receive mode, it is sucking up energy from that area. And the mass, the metallic mass that you're talking about, is casting a shadow on that area, and obviously the metallic mass is a small fraction of one square foot, and therefore the echo it creates, the shadow it creates, is very minor. So the true gain degradation from that phenomena is almost always under a tenth of a dB. That's phenomena number one. Let me drop. Phenomena number two is that depending on where that mast is located, it's going to be relatively close, in other words, only less than a foot away in many cases, from the nearest two directors, or the director and the driven element, on a vertically polarized Yagi. Phenomenon number two is that the metallic mast, in its proximity, is adding some extra capacitance to the tips, to the lower tips of those elements, and tuning them to a slightly lower frequency. That phenomena, probably in the average case, is losing you something like half a dB. It's not a showstopper. If you're a real persnickety guy and you want to make careful measurements, you could retune the length of those directors to accommodate the mast. So if the antenna was designed for horizontal mounting on a metallic mast, but because you care about vertical polarization and you've drilled a new set of holes for the U-bolt clamp and now you're mounting it vertically polarized, you're going to lose a little bit of performance. You could ignore it. It's not going to explode. It's not going to catch on fire. Nothing bad's going to happen. The standing wave ratio, if you measure it, will tell you right away if something really terrible is happening. But then if you want to go the next step, you could retune the length of that element, shorten it a little bit, because a Yagi only requires the elements to be at a particular tuned frequency to get the Yagi performance. So you could readjust the length of the element, compensating for the presence of the mast, and then come all the way back to nearly perfect performance. Now, whether you make the mast out of PVC, fiberglass, or aluminum, the difference in the capacitance you add is rather minor and almost similar, because most likely you're going to run the transmission line down that mast. So even if you make it out of an insulated material, you're still putting another metallic conductor there and adding this extra capacitance. For the first step, I say ignore it. Just go and make believe there's no problem. If you're now getting down to the last bit of performance improvement, because let me drop this. You've already bought a good brand of transmission line, so you don't have very much transmission line loss. You're already using a good low-noise preamplifier, and you're looking for state-of-the-art performance because you want to talk to a satellite or moon bounce or whatever. Then you start worrying about these fine details and retuning for it. But for the most part, I think it's nowhere near as much of a problem as everyone thinks it is. What's your experience on that one, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, there's where the problem is. You see where the question comes in. Let's say, for argument's sake, that, your always good suggestion is for VHF, UHF, is use hardline. You said the price is always right, that you find the right place that has it laying around. And now you dress this hardline from the driven element to the center, and you're using PVC as your support type. It's vertically polarized. What happens with the hardline being dressed down by the mast, in the mast, whatever it is? Aren't we getting back to the same situation of presenting a metallic object in line over?
Without a doubt. And whether that metallic object be a piece of RG8 cable, or whether it be a piece of 3/4-inch hardline CATV cable, and it's lying parallel to the mast or running down the center of the mast, these are relatively minor perturbations for a 2-meter Yagi. On a case of a 1296 Yagi, the mast is going to have a much bigger impact. But in the case of a 6-meter or a 2-meter Yagi, the area of the antenna is so big compared to the shadow of the mast, you can essentially forget about that one. The amount of capacitance it adds to the two nearest directors is a relatively minor perturbation. And yeah, it's going to subtract half a dB of gain, and it's going to disturb the front-to-back ratio of the pattern a little bit. If you had 15 dB front-to-back ratio before, now you're going to have 12 dB of front-to-back ratio. It's not a showstopper. So you can lose an awful lot of sleep worrying about that metallic mast in the vicinity of a vertically polarized Yagi. And if you really think that that's a big problem to you, then add some extra mechanical supports and rear mount the Yagi. In other words, mount the Yagi to the mast from behind the reflector. And now the problem really disappears one step further. But until you've performed a station improvement on all the other components involved, transmission line, low noise preamp, and whatever, in my opinion, this is nowhere near as big a problem as everyone thinks it is. Visually, it looks like a terrible problem. Your eye says, boy, that's going to crash and burn. You actually go and do it, you'll be pleasantly surprised how well it works 98% of the time, from my experience, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, sounds good. Now, let's talk about materials. As you, I don't know if you happen to peruse through the new issue of QST, what is it? Yeah, this is a February issue, about that portable beam 2-meter antenna that the gentleman has an article on in there. There's been talk around a certain PVC pipe. If you're going to use it, it is not really the best material to use. Is there any factors that says that, like, for 2 meters or 70 centimeters, that PVC pipe actually has some kind of reactance problem, or does it have any active material in it that will affect an antenna? Over.
Yeah, I'm looking at the article in the February 2011 issue, page 34, 2-meter, a portable 2-meter Yagi, and he's got a PVC pipe in there. And I see what you're worried about, Mel, and let me turn it around backwards. Let's do the opposite. Let's assume that now I'm a antenna engineer, and I want to design an antenna that looks good and really is terrible. I want to design a bad antenna. And so, where the PVC pipe for that boom of that antenna is located, I'm now going to choose the worst material I can think of. Anechoic material that's used to line the walls of an anechoic chamber, carbon granules, a graphite-reinforced piece of tubing. I'm intentionally choosing conductive and lossy materials that I make that boom out of, because I want the performance of that antenna to go down by a full decibel in performance. You give me that requirement, and I don't think I can do it. I can't make that boom bad enough. The nice thing about that design is that, let me drop, that the elements unplug from that boom, they fold up to a nice, small, compact package that you can put into the trunk of a car, and you can transport this for portable operation. That's the good news about this antenna. The greatest weakness of this design, and it's a very minor weakness, is that the conductivity of each one of your directors of a Yagi at the center is very critical. Out of the tips, you could make the tips out of some really highly resistive material, and nothing would happen. But at the center of each one of these directors, where the current is concentrated, if you have anything more than, let me pick a number, 0.05 ohms of resistance at the RF operating frequency with the skin effect, then you're going to get a change in performance. So when these plug-in connectors, these banana plugs or whatever they are brand new and making good contact, no sweat. When you plug those elements in for the 50th time because you've gone on 50 field trip operations with this antenna, I worry a little bit about that resistivity in the center. So when it comes to the loss of that antenna, the integrity of those connectors is way ahead of what you use for that mast, that boom. And if you change that boom from PVC to aluminum because of the magnetic field shunting effect of the aluminum tubing, you'll be very slightly changing the length of the directors, and you could compensate for that. So the selection of that boom material for that Yagi is 98% a mechanical engineering choice. It's got very little to do with the electronics as I see it, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. So in other words, this PVC pipe, if you go into a hardware place and all, you really don't have to worry too much. Basically, let me boil it down so everybody understands. You don't really have to worry too much about the PVC pipe. Whatever they have on hand, in other words, will be sufficient to use in any of these homebrew antennas without any second thought. Correct, over.
Very boring. Disconnecting.
Absolutely, Mel. You can't buy PVC pipe that at 2 meters is lossy enough in that location of that boom to give you a problem. If I took that PVC pipe and filled up the center of it with the lossiest material I can think of, salt water, and then I re-measured the performance of that Yagi. You could measure 0.2 dB of change. Because it is a basically insulating material, and by the way, when it comes to the center of the directors of a Yagi, resistivity of the nearest couple of tenths of an ohm starts making a slight difference in the performance. And now, by way of the boom, which is not making any contact to the elements, you want it to be a lossy material. As I said, if you filled it up with salt water, and you change the concentration of the salt anywhere from zero to infinity, if you know what I mean, I'd be amazed if you had more than a tenth or 0.2 dB of change in the performance of the antenna. You can't buy PVC that's bad enough that's going to stop that antenna from giving you 98% of the performance. Stop worrying about that. You're buying a material that's giving you a physical support and a particular eye beauty, if you know what I mean. You're not buying electrical performance when you buy that PVC boom material. Over to you, Mel.
K2YL.
Go ahead, Bernie.
When I was out in L.A., we used a lot of PVC building quad antennas for transmitter hunting. And, yes, I agree with you, Dick. It's a wonderful property to work with. It's great in many ways. The one caution that I would throw in is that PVC is highly flexible. When you start using PVC as your mast, you run into a lot of problems. So, for example, we hunted with a five-element quad, which was a piece of three-quarter-inch PVC as the main shaft that the kite forms went off of. But our main shaft, we had to put a dowel rod down the middle of it to be able to get it stiff enough to withstand the wind. So just that one input of do be aware that PVC does bend. So if you start talking about mass out of PVC, you may need to reinforce them.
I'm not sure, but I'm guessing that this is, let's say now, 36 times 3. That total mast is, what, about 5 feet long? And it's supporting very little weight, and it's supported in the center. So as long as you choose the right diameter of mast, yeah, you try to make a PVC pipe as a self-standing structure, and you make it 15 feet long. It's going to whip around like crazy. But for this particular, by my standard, short boom out of what looks like a 2-inch diameter PVC, why in the world does a list of materials not list the boom material and tell you its diameter and length? Crazy article. As I look at the article rapidly, I'm trying to find out where they tell me. Well, I can see they plug it together. Alrighty. So they made it in individual pieces that telescope together, both to make it more compact when you break it down for transport, as well as giving you access to each one of those connectors that feed through, and you've got to solder each one of them. So it's really built into a whole lot of little telescoping pieces. But I'm guessing the total length of that thing is like 5 feet. Once again, you'd be hard-pressed to buy any kind of PVC-like material for that antenna that for this particular length is going to give you any physical problem or any electronic problem. Over to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Okay, on page 34, Dick, look where it says making my portable antenna. Go down, halfway down between that, and you'll see it says 1-inch inside diameter schedule 40 PVC pipe. Do you see that? Over.
I do, but what's the total length of that boom?
Okay, it's very confusing. You jump from page to page. Okay, now go over to page 35 and look at the calculation of element dimensions and spacings. Over.
Yep, but once again, it's telling me the length of the elements, spacing is telling me 16.21 inches, so I guess many of the spacings are 16 inches, some of them are 17 inches, so 1, 2, 3, it looks to me like it's under 50 inches, so as I see it, there's approximately 5 feet altogether there. Again, you'd be hard-pressed to find Schedule 40, which is pretty thick wall material, bad enough to not act mechanically the way you desire in this particular application. And they couldn't possibly make the PVC lossy enough, because if I intentionally made it lossy, I wouldn't be able to do it. Over to you, Mel.
Yeah, that's one of the problems with lately with QST. You'll notice that they are with a lot of the articles and construction, you got to look through, read through, and bounce around. It's not a clean, you know, cut list of parts, well, they'll list parts, and then they'll, you know, tell you, you know, not complete story about the layout or whatever in all one shot. They'll tell you to go to one of their websites, to the ORG, to get further information. I don't know. Lately, I think it's getting complicated for people that, you know, not used to this this technology. They're going out of their way to make things a little too hard to understand like this. This should have been, you know, a nice diagram, drawing of the antenna, you know, with everything spaced out and all that. But all right, so it's, I guess it will work as is. Am I correct? Over.
Yeah, you and I would like to see a nice list of materials. And you go down that list, you buy the parts, and you got a weekend left over, and you know you've got everything in the shack that you need, and you start putting it together. You got to do a little more digging with this article. It's nicely illustrated, and it's a nice design if you like portable antennas. So when it comes to a portable 2-meter beam that you can set up on a tripod in your apartment in New York City, or to go mountain topping or a beachfront operation, set it up on a tripod, this looks like a fairly nice antenna. There's lots and lots of wooden boom Yagis where the elements are made out of coat hanger and all other kinds of materials. When it comes to a 2-meter Yagi, that's about the easiest antenna in the world. Unless you're really all thumbs with tools, you should be able to make it. And even if it looks homely, it can still perform very, very well. Now it's just a matter of pride of making it pretty. Let me drop. That very first transistor that they built in 1947 at Bell Laboratories is a really ugly looking thing, but it had gain. And so to make this thing so ugly that it no longer performs, you'd have to really work at it, if you know what I mean. I think this is a relatively foolproof design, but the article could have had a nice list of filler materials as I see it. Of all the 2-meter Yagis that a guy could build right now as a beginning 2-meter amateur, I guess I'd have to go over to my antenna manual, my ARO antenna manual, which I've got it on the shelf right here. So in the next 10 minutes or so, I'll start paging through it. But I don't think I'm going to find a 2-meter antenna with directivity that is much easier to build than this one. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
As you said, meat, and as he says in the article, you throw it in the trunk of the car and take it with you. You go out to some place you want to set it up. You can twist it around, make it vertical. As he says, it'll twist very easy around on the T-connector that supports it, so you don't have to do any gluing. He says to just push it in, and it's tight enough that you can pivot, make it vertically polarized or horizontally polarized, and why not? You're in business. You can have a lot of fun, a little nice little four-element antenna, and no doubt you can have a heck of a lot of fun with a handy talkie using that antenna. That will give you a lot more bang for the buck out of the handy talkie, for sure. So, all right, so go for it. That's what we'll suggest. And I think that you can alter the materials somewhat. If you can't find the aluminum rod and you haven't got a, like he says, go to a weld shop and buy length of aluminum rod, I would say most likely stiff, hanger wire. I think hanger, regular, good old-fashioned hanger wire should be stiff enough, I would assume, Dick, over.
Without a doubt. As you make a change in the diameter of the directors, there's a little bit of length adjustment that you should do. Again, it's not going to stop it from working. It's not a showstopper. But when you get that last little bit of performance, know that that's a factor. I'm looking at the ARRL antenna book. Chapter 18 is the VHF antennas. And they've got a very simple ground plane antenna. But the very first Yagi that's in that section, I'm disappointed to find that it's the extremely high performance K1FO 22 element Yagi, which for a beginner, that's a bit much. Then the next antenna is a 144 megacycle 2-element quad with wooden construction and what looks like 14-gauge house wire or something equivalent. That's very easy to build. I'm looking at the next Yagi. Oh, then the next one is a Quaggy antenna. This is the Wayne Oberbeck antenna. A wooden boom or a plastic boom, cubicle quad, reflector and driven element, and everything else is normal dipole-like elements out of what looks like coat hanger wire or something very similar. Very easy to construct. Okay, and then they start going into microwave antennas. And this crazy guy with the 12-foot dish. You don't want to build one of those. Okay, so there's not as many VHF simple-to-construct antennas in the ARO antenna book as I expected. I'm a little bit disappointed on that one. I'm trying to remember now. I know that if you Google the right words, there's a zillion articles on rather simple-to-build 2-meter Yagi-like antennas, with often with wooden booms and sometimes metal booms. Over to you, Mel, K2LIW.
Comment, and 2ABG.
Go ahead, Dave.
N2APG, Dave Massapequa. I've found an interesting source of some material that could be used for antenna construction, VHF, UHF. It's the two thin pieces of metal that you'll find that sandwich the rubber on the windshield wiper blades. You can take it all apart. Most of the wiper blades, you get two nice pieces of metal stripping. And you can make some nice antennas out of that stuff.
Yeah, I think it's essentially a stainless steel material. And although it's nice and whippy for construction and nice and strong, if you are making that into a driven element and you wanted to make electrical contact to it, the fact that I think it's stainless would give you a little bit of a problem. You might have to go to your hardware store and buy something called Tinner's solution or Tinner's fluid that when you put that on stainless steel will allow you, with a little bit of care, to solder to it. But ordinarily, making contact to stainless steel is a little bit troublesome. Over to you, Dave, for some comments on that. K2LIW.
Okay, what I've done is filed it down a little bit before, attempting to solder it. I filed the surface down a little bit, and then I used some solder flux. And I've had some pretty good results with it.
Okay, see, we're able to solder to it. Alrighty, want to choose another item out of your mailbag? It's up to you, Mel, K2LIW.
Okay, just going to give you one quick chuckle. One of the guys made a antenna for 2 meters out of, no, for 70 centimeters out of a hanger. And it didn't work at all, he says, because we don't know what we're doing. Do you know why it didn't work, Dick? Over.
He wanted to make electrical contact and didn't scrape away the black paint. Over to you, Mel.
Oh, we didn't specify it had to be a wire hanger, that we just said a hanger, and he made it out of plastic. Over.
Now, was that person possibly kidding you, Mel, or do you think he really made a electrical antenna element out of a plastic hanger? Over to you, Mel.
It was just for to make a chuckle out of it and all. A bit of a strange person that lives in Florida now, so I won't mention names. He also walked around. He had a hat. He walked around with a rotating antenna, a Yagi on top of his hat, a small Yagi. He walks around with it and rotates on top of his hat. Over.
Okay, he's a good crafty guy. Do you want to go to another mailbag item? It's your choice, Mel.
Hey, okay. Well, here's one. Oh boy, let's see. I live in the country during the summertime, and I bought an antenna called the Gem Quad. God, I don't even remember what that is even. The Gem Quad, maybe somebody knows what it is. Now, I found that goes from 10 to 10, 15, 17, 20 meters, and the antenna is going to have to be located a couple of hundred feet from my ham shack. They suggested I feed it with open wire feeders, 450 ohm open wire feeders. How do I do this? That's a good question. How do you feed a quad with open wire feeders, Dick? I get a gem quad. I don't know what a gem quad is. I'll be honest with you, but all right, let's take it as just a quad, over.
If there are antennas, with cubicle quad in particular, that are designed to be fed with 600 ohm, 450 ohm open wire line. And the nice thing about open wire line is it's about the lowest loss, as long as you're on a on an HF frequency, it's about the lowest loss line you're going to get. And it's not expensive, and it can be homebrewed. You can make those spreader plastic insulators out of any materials you've got around the house, and the wire itself can be 14 gauge household wire with the insulation on it if you like. So making the transmission line is very inexpensive, very low in loss, that feeds the antenna, and the antenna is intended to be fed with that cable. That's the easy part. The part you have to do a little bit of work on is that almost everything we can buy these days has got a coaxial connector on it, an unbalanced transmission line output connector. So you have to do a little bit of work of either converting to build a balancing device that takes your coaxial feed line and ends up with a network that feeds open wire line correctly in the differential manner. Or the sophisticated approach is to buy an antenna tuner that has those two great big porcelain insulators coming out the back, which is intended to directly feed open wire line. But even if you got that, you've got another little bit of a problem, and that is to transition from the outside of the house to inside of the house with open wire line mechanically is a little bit of a pain. An awful lot of guys will do that by having a coaxial cable go through the wall and then use a balancing device on the outside. So when it comes to an open wire fed antenna, the shack end of the open wire is the real problem. The wire itself and the antenna end is the easy part from my point of view. Over to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay, I see now. He's got a little diagram here. I see what he sent me here. I couldn't make out what this is, but now you brought it up, I can now visualize what it is. It does have a coax connector, a molded block, where the wires are actually go into this block, and they're molded, it's molded together, and it has a PL259 connector on it. How the heck do you get that? So what do you do? How do you make the transition then, simply on a system like that? What you have to do is remove that block and put an insulator there, or a space like maybe a 1.5-inch insulator? Or what would you do? How would you make it? Can you think of a simple way to make a transition at that point? Getting it into the shack is not so big a deal. You can always, make feed through. But what do you do with the antenna, Dick? And do you have to retune anything, you think, because it's going to change the impedance or whatever? Over.
If your question is how to make a transition between coax and open wire, is that your question, Melanie? Double check that one before I go off on a big tirade on this one. Go ahead.
Well, I just found a picture here of the gem. The gem quad antenna. It sees 1, 2, 3, 4 wires. Let's see. And it's also supported. In other words, it's 4 parallel wires. In other words, it just gets bigger. Starts out a 10-meter quad. It just gets bigger as you go up, go down in frequency. And how the heck do you feed that? In other words, instead of it's fed with, normally it comes fed with has a coax connector. Now you want to put 450 ohm wire on instead of going through it with coax. That's where the problem is. Now I get the question. How do you do that? Over.
My favorite poor man's adaption from coax to any kind of twin lead like wire is a so-called half-wave coax balun. You take a piece of coaxial cable that with your velocity factor at your frequency is a half wavelength long, and you bend it into a U shape, and shield to shield get connected together. The input piece of coax cable also has a shield. Those three shields all get wired together in one spot. And then you take the center conductor of the input coax cable, connect it to one end of the half-wave coax balun center conductor, and now the two center conductors of the coax, of the half-wave coax balun, are the differential feeds for the open wire line. That is a 4-to-1 impedance matching device. So if you started off with 50-ohm coax, that ends up as a 200-ohm impedance differential feeding device at that frequency. And 200 ohms on a 450-ohm line, it's not ideal, but your antenna tuner can handle that. So that's one very simple transition, the so-called half-wave coax balun. Now there's various ways with toroidal devices of making it more ideal. But do you know of a very simple, more simple than that, transition between coax and twin lead-like transmission lines? Over to you, Mel, K2LAW.
It used to be Jerry Civic, W2FMI, remember, had that, and he described that. He called it the UNUN, UNUN. You remember that thing, unbalanced to unbalanced, no, unbalanced to balance. He used to call them, what, UNUNs or something like that. I think that was, maybe you've got the right idea. Put one of them right there. Come right out, you know, put the PL-259 right onto the, and then go right at that point with the 450-ohm line. I think Jerry Civic used to show how to do that. Am I correct, over?
You're absolutely right, but he pronounced it as an un-un, an unbalanced to unbalanced, or a balanced to unbalanced. There's various ways of doing it, balancing devices. He had a number of toroidal wound things that'll give you any impedance ratio you want and balanced to unbalanced transition. So the Jerry Civic set of articles, and if you just simply Google those words, you'll find a lot of articles by W2FMI, if I remember his call letters correctly, on how to do that. But starting off with a half-wave coax balun is the first step. It's not a perfect impedance match. But the main thing with open wire line is you'd like to be feeding it in the differential manner. In other words, at one instant of time, if you're putting plus 1 volt on the right-hand wire, at the exact same instant, you want to be putting minus 1 volt on the left-hand wire. That's full differential feeding as opposed to common mode feeding. Although with the full-wave loop Yagi, full-wave loop square antenna that you've got up in the air at 80 meters, as we all know, slowly transitioning between between differential feeding and common mode feeding has a huge advantage when it comes to electronically tuning that antenna for certain polarizations and angle of arrival. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, I say UNUMS. That's because Jerry told me that word when I spoke then. I won't tell you how he derived that. I can't say it on the air, how he derived that name, UNUS. That's what he called it, UNUS. But it was taken off of a certain description of a certain person. Anyhow, we had a good laugh about that. I remember sitting in his backyard. I don't know if anyone makes that. In other words, we looking for, you have to try to find. I think that is the way to go. Look up Jerry Civic. W2FMI, Frank Mary India, W2FMI, and see exactly how he did that. He described that exactly as a box, how to put this thing in a plastic box so that you can go at that point, right at the antenna, transition from that. So you're going to going from unbalanced to balanced. Really, I think that's basically how to, I'm trying to picture that thing. Yeah, it had, I think, a couple connections. It was like, he had the box exactly laid out like that, that it just hung right on the antenna. So I think that's the best way to go, Dick. The only way I can think of, because it's got that PL-259 on there already, over.
Yeah, once a person understands the vocabulary, a feeding open wire low loss transmission line in a differential manner as opposed to a coaxial cable, which is an unbalanced transmission line. Once a person knows the difference of those two pieces of vocabulary and knowing that making the transition between the two, if you're a purist, is something that you should concentrate on. as a quick and dirty method of getting on the air. You could make operation by taking the shield of your coax cable, connect it to the left-hand wire of the open wire line, take the center conductor of the coax cable, connect it to the right-hand wire of the open wire line. It's a very non-ideal way of feeding it, but at each of frequencies it will work. You'll end up with a slightly high standing wave ratio, and you'll end up with some current flowing down the transmission line, the open wire line, and it'll do some radiating. But it's not going to explode. It's not going to do anything really terrible. You'll have some undesirable standing wave ratio because a 50-ohm line is feeding a 450-ohm line. So in theory, you're going to have a 9-to-1 standing wave ratio. If you've got an antenna tuner with enough range, you're at least on the air. And then adding the half-wave coax balun is going to knock down the standing wave ratio to something like 2-to-1. And then if you use one of these devices by Jerry Civic, which are I don't think you can find them. Let me drop on any of the websites that where we buy electronic components. I don't remember seeing a device you can buy which makes the transition between a 50-ohm coax cable and 450-ohm or 600-ohm open wire line. I don't remember seeing one of those. Do you remember seeing one of those, Mel? They may exist, but they're not very popular. K2KW.
The only one I could think of is go to one of those places that sells. I see they advertise QST in the back that they sell all kinds of antennas. What the heck is the name of that company? Somebody told me the name of that guy. I can picture it. The catalog, the white cover catalog. I think they had a whole bunch of different gadgets like that in there because they sell a lot of, you know, ZEP antennas and folded dipoles and inverted beads all kinds of things. They just may have something like that in there. Radio Works or something like that. That's the only thing I can suggest to find that. Yeah, I guess you can do it. See what happens. Take a shot at it. Do it like Dick just said. Just take a PL259 and solder the wire to PL259, you know, to the center of one piece and to the shell the other piece and see what happens. Maybe it'll work right. I don't know. I'm not sure, Dick. I've never tried that over.
Are you saying you've never built a half-wave coax balun, Mel? I built lots of those to feed a 50-ohm line to 300-ohm twin lead. And although the half-wave coax balun is a 4-to-1 ratio thing, it is a pure differential feed. And by the way, that is the feed that's on the driven element of an RIW-19 Yagi. Although it's a 4-to-1 impedance ratio, which brings you up to 200 ohms, and 200 ohms feeding 300 ohm transmission line is a 1.5 standing wave ratio. Not bad. So I build lots of those. I think you're saying you don't have quite as much experience with a half-wave coax balun. Is that true, Mel?
You said not to use it, not to use the balun. Just go right to the antenna where the PL259 is. Just connect the wire right up there to one of the 450-ohm wires. Just connect it to the sensor there. And the other one connected to the shell without anything. You said just go direct without any balance or any kind of devices over.
I said you could do that in a pinch, and it will work, but it's not ideal. But the half-wave coax balun is a hell of a lot better, and the Cadillac approach is the real baluning device made to go between coax and open wire line. And so with this Radio Works, I think you're saying maybe they've got one of those, and the FMI, W2FMI, Jerry Civic articles have those. Okay, let's see if we've got Glenn on board. KC2QIQ, are you available tonight, Glenn? K2RIW in the TechNet?
Sort of, Dick. Good evening, KC2QIQ. Yeah, I've just been listening in the background here, taking care of a couple of things, but I'll be listening. I'm going to be between the base here and the mobile for a little while.
Okay. Will you be within communication range for the next 5 minutes so I can pose a illustration using you? Or should I wait till later when you're going to have a bigger chunk of time when you're available? Go ahead.
I have to drop a few things off at the post office, but maybe around 10:30. Does that sound about right?
Okay. We've got a date. Around 10:30, you and I will talk. Okay. John and Mel, we'll take you guys now, and then we'll pick up with by reproducing what took place at 1 o'clock in the morning.